The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something, and what it is about.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
Of course, it is a different way.
Welcome back to the Mirror Football Podcast with me, Steve Anglesey. Joining me today will be Daily Mirror's chief football writer, Martin Lipton. He's been on the Chelsea beat all week. He'll be talking Andre Villas-Boas and transfer targets. Then we'll be joined by Andy Mitten of United We Stand, the Manchester United fanzine. We'll be talking his love of Barcelona, the city, the players, Manchester United transfer targets, and Andy's newly released paperback, United We Stand, Manchester United in the 1980s. First up today, we're joined by the Daily Mirror's chief football writer, Martin Lipton. You can read him on mirrorfootball.co.uk, of course, or follow him on Twitter at Martin Lipton. Martin, a few weeks ago in the aftermath of Chelsea firing Carlo Ancelotti, you described them as not being a proper club anymore. Your thoughts on now they've hired Andre Villas-Boas, are they a proper club anymore? How do we pronounce Villas-Boas as well?
I think it's Villas-Boas.
Villas-Boas.
I think it'll be Villas-Boas.
Yeah, or Villas-Boas, yeah.
Look, the reality is that they've made a massive gamble here. It could be an absolutely fantastic appointment. I mean, he's done really well at Porto, as we know, as Mourinho did. But we're talking about a 33-year-old who is younger than the reserve goalkeeper, who's the same age as Drogba and Lampard, who's only a few months older than Cole and Terry and other of these players. And a lot of these players remember him as a pretty peripheral figure who turned up on a Thursday or Friday with a dossier, which sometimes they would have read with intensity, sometimes they may have just glanced at and thrown away, you know, what footballers are like. And he's got a massive task on his hands to plant his authority on the dressing room from minute one of day one. And also, he's got to satisfy the most insatiable owners in the history of football. I mean, they sack managers who win the double because they don't win the title the following year. That's not serious. Real clubs don't do that. Under that basis, Alex Ferguson would have been sacked 4 or 5 times in the last decade by United. They're more intelligent than that. And therein lies the problem, that he has to deal with a very immature club in football terms.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you've touched on the fact that he's so young, and he's going into quite an old dressing room. And we had the unexpected pleasure of, well, it was an expected pleasure, but we spoke to Frank Leboeuf the other day. I'm going to read out some of what he said. I just want your comments on this. He said, "I don't see Chelsea winning it this year. It's not that United are so much better. It's that some of the Chelsea players have been there so long, they are like the bosses. Players have cycles of 5 years, and Chelsea have magnificent players who've been there for 10 years now. A few of them need somewhere else to find their motivation. Not John Terry, he should die at Chelsea, but Drogba and Lampard need to refresh themselves in another place." Is that something you agree with? And more importantly, is that going to be something that Villas-Boas agrees with?
I'm not entirely sure. Well, I would say I think Levert's making a few reasonable points there, and I think it makes a degree of sense. I mean, we weren't just saying at the end of the season that Chelsea were an old squad who needed to be refreshed. We were all saying it last August, and Ancelotti said no, 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 and for once the media were right. We could see the problems, that there was a squad with lots of oldies and lots of youngies and nothing in-betweens. And the in-betweens came in January when it was too late, in Luis and Torres. And of course, you know, Luis lost his way a little bit and Torres never found it, and it was a disaster. Lampard is 33. He wasn't his normal self last year because he missed 4 months of the season. He was still important for them, but he seemed to lack some of the real conviction that he'd had in his earlier Chelsea days. I still think that he's got a part to play in the squad, but I can't believe, if they buy the sort of players they're looking at, the Modrics and Moutinhos and Falcaos, that Lampard can possibly be in the team as a starter in the first choice side by the end of the season. I don't think that's going to be viable. I still think he has important roles to play and will play games, but he won't be a starter. Drogba, again, if Falcao and Torres are both there, what role does he have? He's not going to want to stay as third-choice striker. So there is the problem, of course, with both of them is who could pay their wages. They're on astronomical sums, which clubs outside of Chelsea and Manchester City can't afford to meet.
That's right. Manchester City are having the same problem now, trying to, Roberto Mancini reportedly very frustrated that they can't offload the likes of Adebayor, Sean Wright, Phillips, Craig Bellamy because of these enormous wages. Villas-Boas, well, I mean, we've heard the stories, obviously. We all know that he went to complain to Bobby Robson about Bobby Robson dropping his hero at Porto, and that's how he got his big break, and Robson was so impressed he got him on a coaching course, etc. We know that he was Jose Mourinho's side man, and he was the director of oppositional scouting or what have you. What do we know about the way that he's going to set Chelsea up to play? They're going to play 4-3-3 again, right?
They tend to play 4-3-3. Porto did. It seems to be his way. It's interesting that he used Belushi and Moutinho as the key men in midfield for him. Moutinho normally the holder but pushed on. Belushi was the Argentine, became the real joiner of the team. So you assume he's going to find a holder, which may well be Moutinho, and a joiner, which one has to imagine, looking at the energy of the boy, would be Ramirez as the joiner. And then it seems to be the playmaker in behind the front men. What he also needs is a left-sided contrast. I mean, if you look at Porto, Varela stayed wide and did an awful lot of work wide left, which allowed Falcao and Hulk to do the work through the middle and a more narrow right. So he needs to have one wing quite clearly. And that's what we'll be part of, looking at, again, that and looking at a way of, I think, replicating to a degree that shape. I mean, it's the typical Mourinho way of playing to a degree, which is, you know, win the ball back and hit people hard on the counter. I mean, Mourinho was a counter-attacking coach. It looks like Villas-Boas is the same sort of coach. The difference between Mourinho and Villas-Boas is A, he's younger. B, he's not got the same messiah complex.
Hmm. That's right. Yes, he seems to be a little bit more rational. I mean, although there are people, I've heard people at Chelsea saying that by the time that they both left, Villas-Boas was just as vocal.
He was the winder up in chief.
Yes.
I mean, him and Rui Faria were winding Mourinho up, and therein lies the problem. Because if the board do become interfering, and of course that would never happen at Chelsea, you'd never have gripes from any members of the board or the hierarchy around Roman Abramovich daring to criticise the way they were playing or the performances or the results. But if that ludicrous concept were to take place, there'd be a danger of him thinking, here we go again. And
yeah,
that might be a problem for him. But again, like any manager at Chelsea, unless you win every game, you're failing anyhow.
So Rui Faria were winding, and Villas-Boas were winding him up. In what way were they doing that?
Well, they were just, you know,
we're not getting enough money from them. We're not getting enough credit here.
No credit, no respect. What are they doing? Don't they realise what you've done? Understandably, because let's be honest, they never had a manager like him. He was the most successful manager in the history of the club, and yet he was being constantly castigated from his seniors, by his board, for not doing enough. And you're thinking, well, what more do you want? You can understand their anger and frustration, particularly in the season they lost in the 2006-07, where they lost the league because they had no centre-halves when it really mattered in December and January.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, Mourinho had, we're told anyway, Mourinho had fallen out with some of the senior players by the time he departed. Was that the case with this guy as well? And is that going to be a problem for him when he goes back in and faces up to John Terry? I mean, John Terry's kind of lurking now in the background in the same way that Alan Shearer lurked for Newcastle all those years, isn't he? Is he going to be a future Chelsea manager sooner or later, I would guess?
Well, one would assume so, yes. I mean, and Chelsea will make the decision when the time comes. I think it's eminently reasonable to suspect that it will happen. Terry's still a big beast in that jungle. And I think it is overplayed. There was clearly a dispute at the time between Terry and Mourinho, because Terry was obviously not fit and he didn't think he should be playing. And for Terry to say he's not fit to play says it all, really. He must have been really in a bad way. Managers and big players do have disputes. That's part of football. I mean, it's right that you have them, because big men then just put their ego to one side and reunite under a common cause, and more often than not, they become successful as a consequence. So what happened 4 years ago is not really relevant, I don't think, to what will happen now. It's what happens in the next 4 months rather than happened in 2007. That will be definitive and in terms of the season that Chelsea are going to go through.
Absolutely. transfer targets now? Obviously, we've said Falcao. Is that Falcao has said that he wants to go to Chelsea? Is Hulk a possibility? I mean, will
I don't see Hulk. I have to say, I mean, it's always possible, but you can't get them all into the team. You've got Torres there already. I think Moutinho is more likely as the holder. There's talk of Dani Alves today, and they do need a right back unquestionably because their best right back is actually a centre half in Ivanovic. The other right backs, Paulo Ferreira, old, Bazingua, rubbish. They need a better alternative there. Whether anyone would want to leave Barcelona for Chelsea, I doubt, to be honest. But there you go.
Absolutely, and they're not really in the Alexis Sanchez thing. Is Modric still a goer for them?
Well, he's certainly someone they want. Whether it's going to happen, I mean, I'm told by Spurs at the moment the mood is whatever the price, whatever the valuation, whatever the bid, it doesn't matter. He is not going. They were very, very angry at the way they felt that Chelsea had tried to destabilise Modric and then put in a bid which they considered utterly derisory. And it's only strengthened Daniel Levy's mindset, which is this is not going to happen under any circumstances. Now, of course, things change in football. But it's not like Berbatov, who only had, you know, a year to go on his contract and could have exercised the Webster clause and gone out and paid it, you know, and gone for virtually nothing. He's got 5 years left. They can hold him. I think that Spurs decision that will be to Modric, give us one more year.
Yeah.
And if we're not in the Champions League, then we'll listen. But we're not standing here this year, and I think Modric is going to have to accept that.
Yeah, absolutely. And as soon as, I mean, you did hear Harry seizing on it immediately, didn't you, and saying, well, if he lets him go now, no one will ever believe anything that Daniel Levy says ever again, which I thought was an interesting choice of phrase from a manager. Just before we let you go, we've covered Chelsea, we've covered Spurs, obviously. Is anything going to happen at Arsenal? Last week they were about to sign Gervinho. The moths were flying out of the wallet. Yeah, absolutely. What happened to that? And will they sign anybody?
I think Gervinho is still going to happen. I think they are still going to buy. I think Samba is clearly very much in their sights. So there you go. I mean, I anticipate that things will happen. Actually, I think there need to be a change there, but quite how and when. And yeah, from the outside, it looks as though they've been left behind again, doesn't it? Which is not going to go down well with the fans, who clearly are less than impressed.
They are. Thank you very much to Martin Lipton.
Football is about nothing unless it's
the Mirror Football podcast theme music is the cunningly titled Football by the band Piers. That's P-E-E-R-S. Check them out at myspace.com/wearepiers. myspace.com/wearepiers.
Next today on the Mirror Football podcast, we're talking to Andy Mitten, familiar to Manchester United fans as the editor of the United We Stand fanzine. He's a writer in 442 and a columnist for the Manchester Evening News. You can also follow him on Twitter at Andy Mitten, M-I-T-T-E-N. Andy's book, We're the Famous Man United, Old Trafford in the 80s, is just out in paperback, and we're going to get to that in a second, Andy. But you're well known for living in Barcelona and for interviewing Nou Camp players like Messi and Xavi and Iniesta. As a United fan, can you sum up the feeling in both of the cities before the Champions League final and afterwards? Were both sides expecting to win?
Yeah, I've divided my time between Manchester and Barcelona for 10 years now, and I was in both cities before and after, although it took my time to get back to Barcelona after the defeat at Wembley because United were hammered. I think the Catalans were very, very confident before the final, and they weren't being arrogant in their eyes because they thought they had the best team in the world by a distance. And in hindsight, I made a fool out of myself because I did a lot of Catalan radio, and I'd say, listen, Sir Alex Ferguson's not going to be bitten twice after what happened in Rome. It's going to be far tighter, and I accept Barca are still favourites, but I really fancy United. And I was wrong, and they were right, because people would look at me, and when I say people, I mean journalists or former players, and they just thought that Barca were far, far better. And I went to Wembley full of false optimism, thinking that United could win. probably my heart overruled my head, because I'd watched United 30 times live last season, and Barca the same, and Barca are a different level. But I also felt that United had done very well in Europe, were very hard to beat, didn't concede goals, went to places like Valencia and came away with a 1-0 victory. And I just thought United would be much better than Rome, because they'd be vengeful because they didn't play in Rome. The players had all said that they were mystified at what happened in Rome, and that was all nonsense. Barca were just as dominant as they were in Rome, fully deserved their victory. And it was a bit embarrassing watching it, and it was a strange sensation, because when you're a Manchester United fan and you watch your team, you're used to them dominating and winning matches. And to see United for 15, 20 minute spells virtually unable to get hold of the ball was a new experience, and one I've not felt since Rome.
Yeah, it was actually like what Manchester United do to teams like Bolton and Blackburn and on a regular basis, wasn't it?
I was gutted because I just seen my team lose again in a European Cup final. But Barca are not arrogant. I've interviewed all of the big name players several times. They're good people. They're just normal lads who are brilliant at football. And someone like Xavi is one of the most interesting people you can interview as a football journalist. And when they see me, they know I'm from Manchester, and they wind me up a little bit. Even Lionel Messi will just go, ha ha, you know, just a little smile. But they're certainly not arrogant. And they've done it the right way. They've brought a lot of those players through the youth system. And, of course, Barca are financially cute. But they've got the great manager, Pep Guardiola. They play wonderful football. But I just got sick of writing about how great they were. And I admired in Manchester for a couple of weeks before walking into a bar in Barcelona last week where all the waiters actually go and watch Barca, because unlike a lot of Barca fans, they do go to games. And they went to Wembley and they just said, you know, we think we were the best team and we deserve to win. And I thought, how can I argue with that? I can't do. I just hope that United can do something next season to close the gap. But I'm not convinced of it at all. I think if the two teams met 10 times, Barca would win 7 or 8 of those games, as they would against any team in the world. So, summing up, I think United did very well to win the league last year and very well to reach the European Cup final.
You obviously, you watch La Liga 1 week, you watch the Premier League 1 week. There's the age-old debate about which is the stronger league. You know, people say that the Spanish league is much more technically superior, which I'd agree with. But then they say there's always only two teams in it. And is that right? Is it totally cut and dried between Real and Barcelona for the next few years? And, you know, how do you see it in terms of how does it square up to the Premier League?
I think it's right that Barca and Madrid enjoy this duopoly now. And it's with sadness that I say that, because during the time I've been in Spain, I've seen great sides like Valencia win the league twice. Sevilla come really close to winning the league in 2007. They also won the UEFA Cup twice on the trot. Deportivo La Coruña, or Super Depor as they were known in Spain, seen them have several great sides and regularly come to places like Barcelona and win. And you go to the Camp Nou and you wouldn't know who would win, and you do know now. And it's the same with watching Manchester United. You tend to go to games at Old Trafford, and it's a major surprise if United don't win. I think the major problem in Spain is the way that television money is distributed. Blackpool received more money from television last season than Atletico Madrid. And Atletico are a huge club, 45,000 average crowds. They were the UEFA Cup, Europa League, sorry, holders. And they get such a small amount of money in compared to the big English teams. And you get these quirks where teams like Wigan or Fulham can outspend huge Spanish clubs. And Spain knows it's got a problem. It knows that a 25-point gap between second and third doesn't look good for the league. But I'm not one of these people who says it's like the SPL in the sun, because there are several teams in Spain who would be in the top half of the Premier League. Villarreal are a fantastic football side. Malaga have spent a lot of money this close season and will be strong next season. Valencia, always in the Champions League, always do well and reach the latter stages, although they've got huge financial problems. So I think there are pros and cons with both. You see more full stadiums in the Premier League. The technical level, yeah, it is higher in Spain, but the competition and sheer sort of enthusiasm and competitive spirit is higher in the Premier League. There's less cheating. I mean, I'd call cheating going over for a foul which you don't deserve. In Spain, that's seen as an art. That's seen as cunning and something that should be rewarded. So there's slight cultural differences there as well. And Real Madrid, you know, they've spent an awful lot of money, more than any team in world football. But they've got a fantastic side, and their fans are saying now that they're the second best in the world. And had they got to Wembley, they would have given Manchester United a far better game. They may have done, but they didn't get to Wembley.
Yeah, so Casillas certainly said that, never mind the fans. I mean, just going back to Wembley, in the post-match press conference, Fergie was the first, virtually the first thing he said was that the challenge now was to match Barcelona, to try and emulate Barcelona. The signings that he's made so far don't seem to indicate that, do they? They seem to indicate that his priority is the bread and butter of the league. Phil Jones, Ashley Young. Is that right? Will there be more signings, do you think, who will get them closer to Barcelona?
I think they will. I don't think anyone can compete with Barcelona at the moment. Real Madrid have tried. Real Madrid have bought Ronaldo, Kaká, Benzema, Xabi Alonso to add to the world-class players they already had. And they still were hammered 5-0 by Barcelona. It's not pointless to try and compete, because there's always a challenge, and Sir Alex Ferguson always talks about the challenge, but this Barcelona team is dominant. They might lose occasional cup matches, but I think you've got to wait until they either internally combust, which could happen in Spain, or the likes of Xavi, who's 31, becomes 35 and becomes less influential. But for the time being, and with Guardiola in charge, Barcelona could reign in a manner which hasn't been seen since Milan over 20 years ago in Europe. Manchester United signings, when they signed Phil Jones, people were saying, who? But that's the way Sir Alex Ferguson has started to operate. And I quite respect him for that, because when United signed Chicharito just over a year ago, there were a lot of cynical United fans saying, is this what we've been reduced to? £8 million players who nobody's heard of from the Mexican League. I think he was a brilliant signing. I think he was fantastic. Scouted by Manchester United, and he's proved himself in the Premier League, hugely popular among the supporters. And I get far more satisfaction from United signing a player like that than a marquee A-grade, you know, Kaká style player. And Ferguson has pulled in names like Nemanja Vidic or Patrice Evra, who were known in football and they were known among the scouts, but they weren't known among a lot of supporters before they signed for Manchester United. And I think he does really well there. And sometimes he does pay £30 million for your Ferdinands or your Berbatovs. But I quite like United's transfer policy, and I trust him. I've seen Phil Jones play twice. He played well. He didn't stand out to me as someone as to say Manchester United have got to sign him now. But I trust Alex Ferguson's judgment, because he's built such a huge bank of credit up in the time he's been at Old Trafford. I'd be foolish not to. I think there will be more signings this summer. But if Sir Alex Ferguson has got Tom Cleverley or Ravel Morrison or Daniel Welbeck lined up to play 30 or 40 games this season, I trust him. He sees the players every day. I don't. I'm a journalist. I'm a fan. He does. He's got good people around him, and he's proved people wrong time and time again.
Yeah. Well, we spoke about this before, but we like Ravel Morrison. We really like Pogba. I think he's good, and maybe this year, maybe next year. Your book, We're the Famous Man United, that ends with at the end of the 1980s with United on the verge of glory under Ferguson, just about to win their first trophy, obviously after the events of 23rd of September 1989. I don't know. Well, I think Mark Hughes scored, didn't he? Yeah.
I know that some of his best mates are City fans, and he didn't shut up about it for 5 years.
There you go. Did what happened to United in the 1980s? Obviously, that's when you grew up. That's when I grew up. Were they anywhere near, or were Liverpool just too good, or did United underachieve?
Liverpool were too good, and when I spoke to all the 80s players for that book, they all said it's easy to say we beat Liverpool in one-off games, but they were the best team by a distance. They had everything. They had the skill of the likes of Dalglish, the aggression of people like of Graham Souness, and a brilliant mentality. They didn't fluke European Cups and league titles. They were the best English team by a distance. And United fans, we had our heroes. You know, Brian Robson, I think, would have got into that Liverpool team. He was the captain of England. He was a wonderful player. And United came relatively close a couple of times and to winning the league for the first time since 67. And if you speak to the players, as I did, and say, you know, the drinking culture at the club, did that stop Manchester United winning the league? One or two of them said, yeah. Frank Stapleton said, had there not been that rampant drinking culture at Old Trafford in the 80s, we would have won the league three times. Now, that's easy for him to say that. And it should also be pointed out that Liverpool could drink with the best of them. And that was a culture in British football at the time. But I don't think it helped professional athletes go on 12-hour benders, which the United players did all of the time. There's a few reasons why United didn't win the league. They didn't pay as well as they can do now. They balk at some of the more expensive players who were identified by the managers, just as they've done in the 70s and 80s. So it was, they never had their sort of buying power to be an all-conquering team. Also, they didn't have a good youth setup, and that's one thing which Sir Alex Ferguson did when he came in 1986. He revamped it completely. He started bringing players through. So whereas United had brought a couple of players through in the 80s, such as Norman Whiteside, he fell into bad ways. He drank too much, and he never fulfilled his potential.
Yeah, I mean, booze was my next question, really, and obviously that was quite a fearsome drinking circle of Robson, Whiteside, McGrath. Were the players quite open to talk about those things, or was it something that they wanted to brush under the carpet?
They talked about it. I said to all of the players, if you agree to do this book, you'll all get paid the same amount of money. It wasn't a huge amount of money, but I want a four-hour interview with all of you. I don't want the cliches. I want warts and all. I want you to tell me what went on in your life at Manchester United. And they all agreed to that. And some of the players told me too much. I had to protect them by leaving stuff out. You know, one player told me absolutely everything, and then he asked for copy approval, which I don't normally give him. I let him read it. I thought he's just going to put a red line through all of it. And he said, a bit about my ex-wife, can you not have a bit of a go at her? Because she was a proper bitch, you know. No, I cannot. But he talked about the drinking, and someone like Gary Bailey, who came from a university-educated background, middle-class background in South Africa, he was an athlete. He was completely alien to him that sportsmen would go out on these benders, which started after training on a Tuesday and carried on until the early hours of Wednesday morning. He just couldn't relate to it, and he didn't think it enhanced the team at all. But I spoke to other players, such as Brian Robson, who said it was part of the team bonding. We had some of our best moments when we were out drinking. If there are any issues which needed ironing out between players, they were better done 6 or 7 pints in than done in the dressing room, because they were taken in the right spirit then. And that was very much the mentality of those days. And then you have someone like Arnold Muren, who came over from Holland. He'd never drank alcohol in his life. And he came to Ipswich Town with Franz Tyson. And he said after 6 weeks, Tyson had become English. He said he owned a snooker queue and he was drinking pints of bitter. And he said, I never succumbed, which caused much suspicion in the dressing rooms at Portman Road and Old Trafford, because he thought I was importing some magical potions from Holland. He said it wasn't. It was just a sports drink, because I was a sportsman.
It's, well, I guess that's why both of those clubs had to hire Alan Brazil, just to sort of balance up the Arnold Muren thing there. Was there anyone that you couldn't get? And if not, I mean, who was the biggest surprise and delight to interview? Who did you think was not going to be good, who ended up being very engaging?
John Gidman, absolute crazy, colourful Scouser, who led a very colourful life and wound up in Marbella. And he met me at 9 in the morning off the plane from Malaga and said, we can have a bevy or what? And 6 hours later, he was spilling out his life story. Probably the least known name in the 80s book is Billy Garton, and he played 50 times for Manchester United. Incredible life story. Grew up in Salford, walked across the Trafford Road Bridge to play for Manchester United's first team. Then he got struck down with ME, or Yuppie's disease, as they called it in the 80s, and he had to stop playing football. He was about to sign for City, but he wouldn't have passed his medical. He considered suicide 3 times. His marriage fell apart. His life fell apart. And then he started researching his illness, not before throttling Sir Alex Ferguson in the tunnel at Old Trafford and Fergie back down, as he should have done with Billy. And Billy then trained to be a school teacher. He rose quickly, became deputy head. Then he got offered a job coaching in America, and he's now in charge of a soccer school in San Diego. And life's brilliant. He's remarried. He's got a great family. And I found that was a real sort of inspirational story.
Yeah.
And then the others could not get anybody. There's two I tried to get, which was Paul McGraw and Norman Whiteside. And the reason they couldn't do the interview in 2006 when they did the book was because they both had autobiographies coming out. So they didn't want to give all the best stories to me when they'd signed a deal to do their autobiographies. But I just had to live with that. I got plenty of other good people and enjoyed all of them. And to sit in front of Clayton Blackmore and for him to say to me, "You know what, I've never told my dad that I love him," I thought, gosh, I was not expecting that from Clayton Blackmore. With the greatest respect, I didn't expect him to go that deep. And then there were the obvious names, Ron Atkinson, Brian Robson. There were a couple of players who said, "Is there any chance we can do it for cash only?" And I said, "No, we can't do it for cash only." So the old habits have died hard with a few of them. But it was Gordon McQueen. He met me in Yarm, where he lives near Middlesbrough. Took me to his local pub and said, "I want a few beers to warm us up." 3 pints. He then took me to another pub. Told me hilarious stories, you know, some of them which are not fit for family consumption, but made it into the book. And then his wife, Yvonne, picked us both up at 5 o'clock, and she said, "You've been drinking, haven't you, Gordon?" He said, "Yeah, but it's closed season." She said, "But you retired 21 years ago." "I don't care. I'm having a beer." And, you know, they still like a pipe now, a lot of the lads. And what pleases me most is that I kept in touch with most of them. I said to all of them, "Look, you're good enough to give me your life story. I'm not going to stitch you up. I've been writing about Manchester United a long, long time. I'm not disappearing into the sunset." And I know of several players who've bought several copies of the book and they're pleased with it. And same again with the 90s lads. And I'm working on a 70s one at the moment. And that's great fun as well. It really is a privilege to be paid to go and interview these people. Many of them were childhood heroes of mine.
Yeah, well, we're gonna get you on again when the 70s one comes out, definitely. Before we let you go, I mean, back to Barcelona. Which of these guys is going to be in Barca's? I mean, it's quite a horrible new shirt, isn't it? Their new shirt. Which of these guys is going to be playing in that shirt next season? Fabregas, Sanchez, and David Villa. All three.
I would say almost certainly Alexis Sanchez, because he wants to play for Barca. That's the strongest reason. Fabregas will run and run and bore everybody to tears because he wants to play for Barca. Arsenal don't want to sell him. Arsenal don't need to sell him. Barca don't have the money to go above 35 million euros. They think that Fabregas' desire to leave will wear Arsenal out in the end. David Villa, I think he'll stay. I interviewed him several times last season. He did well. He wasn't Messi level. He wasn't utterly spectacular, but then he was played out of position for a lot of time, just as Thierry Henry was as well. And he adapted well. He didn't go moaning about it like the likes of Samuel Eto'o have done in the past. And he's popular in the dressing room. Guardiola likes him. He scored a lot of goals. He's played in the Champions League final. So I would say that David Villa will stay, and there'll be a few outgoing fringe players. Bojan will move probably to Roma, where Luis Enrique, a former Barca great, has become manager, and fringe players like Jeff Wren. But I think it will be much of the same for Barcelona next year, and their attitude is, why change a winning formula? They just want to add to it, bring in one or possibly two players, but it won't be much more than that. And they're in a great position to do it because they can say, look, we're in Barcelona, which is desirable to a lot of players as a place to live. And unfortunately, Manchester loses out when it comes to that. And they can say, we're the best team in the world. And it's hard to argue with that at the moment.
It's very hard to argue with it. Andy Mitten, thanks very much. And thank you to Martin Lipton and to everybody for listening. We'll be back with another Mirror Football podcast next Thursday. I'll see you then.
The Daily Mirror calls on you.
Football is about nothing unless it's about something. And what it is about.
I am going to get 100% out of you.
course, you're very, 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 there's a different wife.